The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
As I said, really excited to have our guest with us today. His name is Sohrab Amari. He is the author of the new book, The Unbroken Thread, just released last month. And this is a powerful, powerful book talking about where we at here as a country here in the United States. Sohrab was born and raised in Iran, and he says that he left the repression in his home country to find freedom in an icon of the West, the U.S. But in his own telling, his new home revealed how excessive freedom can enslave rather than liberate. And I think there's a lot of people who are talking about that. Where are we at as a society today? How do we find a way to move forward? And in a time where there's so much division and toxicity, and a lot of times it's like, is there a way forward? And we're going to talk to Sohrab about that. And Sohrab, I'm so glad you're with us on the Live from Seattle program today. Welcome.
Tim, thanks for having me.
This is fantastic. And, you know, as I just said in the introduction, you came from Iran, and you had all these hopes and dreams, and then you wrote this book as really a guide for your son, Maximilian, who you say was born into a society that in some ways has lost its way. Let's talk about that. What does that look like?
Sure. So I should be clear that I'm very much of a grateful immigrant, and it's precisely out of my love for my adopted homeland, because there's no going back for me to the Islamic Republic, that I wrote a book concerned about the what I would describe as distortions of freedom that have taken root in the West. And all of my immigrants' gratitude can't allay my anxieties when I think about the kind of man that Western civilization as it exists today, and especially the United States, would chisel out of my Max. I should briefly say that he's named after St. Maximilian Kolbe. He was a Polish Franciscan friar who was canonized as a saint by the Catholic Church in 1941 because he died in 1941. He was canonized in the 1980s, and the reason he was canonized was because he famously laid down his life for a stranger at Auschwitz. Both of them were imprisoned by the Nazis. This man was condemned to death, and when he cried out saying, "My wife, my children," St. Maximilian heard that, and he volunteered to go into his place, into this starvation chamber, and that's how he died. So I named my Max, obviously, because I wanted to tether him to this deeper account of freedom that St. Maximilian's action represented, and the whole kind of Christian and classical and traditional formation that made his great sacrifice make sense. And then I look at my Max, and I worry that if just left to the devices of our culture, it will make him, not that he's going to become, I don't know, an opioid addict or something like that, God forbid, but a kind of directionless elite, just living a kind of life of purposeless decadence, where he thinks freedom just means doing as he pleases, quote-unquote, keeping his options open, and ultimately not really binding himself to anything greater than himself. No notion of duty, no notion of sacrifice, and therefore, in a way, being unfree. Even though, compared to his namesake, he has a lot of choice. In fact, St. Maximilian Kolbe climbed the summit of human freedom, and bizarrely or paradoxically enough, he did it at Auschwitz, in a way, in that moment, by making that choice of self-sacrifice, of laying down his life for his friend. St. Maximilian was the freest man in Europe at Auschwitz in 1941. And so my book is an attempt to try to tie my Max to the entire tradition that makes legible and desirable and understandable the sacrifice of his namesake.
Wow, that's unbelievably powerful and inspirational. What were those smelling salt moments, I guess, for you, Sohrab, over, you know, the last, I'm sure, number of years that kind of led you to this point, right? To say, okay, I want to write this to my son. What were those? Were there a few moments that kind of crystallized for you what's happening here in the West?
Yeah, I'll name a few. One was when he was 1 year old. We took a ride. I live in Manhattan, and my wife and I took our 1 year old to take a routine subway ride. This is before the pandemic in the New York subway, and you know there was an ad on the wall. Actually on all the walls of the subway and the trains, because that's how you buy advertising campaigns now, for the dating website OkCupid. And there were variations, but they all played out on the kind of vulgar acronym DTF, which stands for down to, you know, F star star star. Basically saying, you know, we're offering one night stands essentially. And I just wondered, you know, what would I say as a father if my Max were a little older at that time and was able to ask me, you know, Dad, what does DTF mean? And it just got me thinking, like, why is it that the society around me, and I'm no prude, you know, I've lived in big cities my whole life, but why is it that my surrounding society makes it so hard to raise a child into a life of ordinary virtue? I'm not even talking about the kind of extraordinary self-sacrificial virtue of a Saint Maximilian Kolbe, but just ordinary virtue where a reasonable account of why sex is a special thing and it's you know, it's been regulated by every civilization across time and across human civilizations and directed primarily toward the marriage impulse and not toward others. And whereas our society just kind of makes this casual commercialized thing of it, like down to DTF. That was one of them. I'm also, in the book, I imagine my son getting a little older and he's come back from college and, you know, he, in my kind of imagining in the book's introduction, again, it's not that like he's lived a catastrophic life. In fact, he's graduated from an elite university. He's come back home. He's about to take up a job either at a hedge fund or a publishing firm or whatever, but he's just, in a way, morally drifting through life. And, you know, he's been dating this girl for like 10 years and he still hasn't, they have no plan to marry, no plan to have children. They just kind of, quote unquote, keep their options open. And that's a very plausible outcome for elites in my kind of urban milieu, whether that's in Seattle or New York City. The fact that no one binds himself to anything greater than himself, and I think a lot of it has to do with this sense that we've lost of tradition being just a sense of ordered continuity, that there was a path stretching behind you that your ancestors had taken, and then it led into the future, and it actually allowed you to, knowing where you came from, allowed you to leap more confidently into the future and actually make kind of commit to something and therefore actually exercise your freedom rather than just keep your options open. The reason I described this kind of dark scenario for my son, where I imagine him getting older and just kind of being just getting ahead in life without any sort of meaning, is because I see that in my peers today. These aren't even the, you know, people on lower down the economic scale who are really kind of living precarious lives. These are the, you know, upper middle class educated elites going to elite universities, but they're just really not, they have no sense of what it means to be fully human, what it means to be fully free. How do you form a family? Why would you form a family? It all has become a kind of mystery, and, you know, marriage, family formation, childbearing have all become just one more lifestyle. You could choose to do it, and if you're economically lucky enough, you can marry and, you know, do all that. But if not, you know, for plenty of others, you just live this kind of lonely atomized life.
That's so fascinating, Sohrab. We're talking to Sohrab Ahmari. He's the author of the new book, The Unbroken Thread. He's the opinion editor at the New York Post. I want to ask you this because I literally had this conversation with a friend yesterday, and I think it applies in some way, but I want to get your opinion here. So, you know, I live here in Seattle. I'm born and raised here. And, you know, I have four daughters and 11, 10, 7, 5. And when we drive home, we drive right kind of near our house. We drive by. There's three strip clubs. And so we drive by those big signs, right, on the way home every day. And as the girls started to read, you know, you know, all of a sudden they're like, oh, I've seen that building before, but now I can read what it says on the billboard. And one of my daughters says, oh, Showgirls. Ooh, I'm a girl. What kind of show, you know?
Oh, no.
And, so then yesterday, front page of the Seattle Times, the Seattle Times investigative team ran a very significant story on one of our celebrity chefs here in Seattle. He's a two-time James Beard award-winning chef. I mean, really celebrated across the country. His name is Eduardo Jordan. And there had been basically 15 women came out and said he, you know, gave me unwanted sexual touching or sexual assaults and, you know, just a variety of sexual advances, non-consensual. And of course, the city here is like, oh my gosh, this guy, man, he needs to be canceled. He's done. Like, let's make sure his restaurant shut down because this is not right, which obviously I agree with. I mean, that is in terms of like, if you're doing that to women, that's no good. You might need to be in prison perhaps. But I always see this dichotomy between, we're okay with the strip clubs and we're okay with this kind of objectification of women. And hey, man, I drive by three strip clubs on the way home and that's okay. But on the flip side, when, you know, a man or woman or whomever then kind of leads out, even, you know, they've been, you know, prepped in some ways to objectify people and then they actually do something. Well, now, you know, they should, you know, obviously they need to pay the price. And then, and at the same time here in Seattle, you know, we have a mental health crisis, maybe like you do out there in New York City, but we're talking a lot about a mental health crisis, which we have. We have a huge homelessness crisis. And so even again, another story in the Seattle Times on the same day about, oh my goodness, like we've got to, how come we're not doing things about mental health? Our people are struggling with mental health and yet we legalize drugs as well. Right. And we say it's okay to really be on drugs. And so we kind of have this interesting approach where we say, hey, it's okay to objectify women and go to strip clubs and do all that kind of stuff. It's okay to do drugs, but then we also know it's going to lead to the non-flourishing of our communities. Does that stick in any way with maybe where you're approaching things?
Oh my goodness, Tim. These two questions are so perfectly tied to the themes of the book. I should first of all note that I take the format of because I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a theologian, I'm just a journalist and a storyteller. So in order to guide my son, and then hopefully the reader as well, to this kind of deeper account of freedom and what it means to be truly free and happy, that is summed up under the rubric of tradition, I pose 12 questions. Each of them poke holes in one of our contemporary certainties, the things that we take for granted ideologically and don't even question, and we assume that these questions are all been answered or that science or technology have superseded them so that it's no longer necessary to pose these questions. And some of the questions, and each question is paired up with one great thinker. So the idea is we work through the life of one great thinker so that it never hits the reader very sick with philosophy. You're reading a story of a person, and you learn a lot about them along the way, and then the ideas are worked out through the drama of their life. And some of the characters are very predictable. In a book about tradition, you definitely see, you know, St. Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas or C.S. Lewis or John Henry Newman. But it also has a few kind of characters who are unexpected in a book by a traditionalist about tradition. And one of them is Andrea Dworkin, the kind of radical feminist in the 1980s and 90s. And the question that, you know, her life seeks to answer in the book is sex private? And it comes down to exactly what you laid out, because Dworkin, although she was on the kind of typical political spectrum, was on the very hard left. She has sensed and devoted her life to kind of exposing how the ideology of sexual liberation had paradoxically left us less free, and especially for women and children, had led to all sorts of degradation and the loss of human flourishing, as you said, Tim. And that schizophrenia lies in this. And again, you summed it up. We, on the one hand, we're told that every kind of sex is good, or nearly every kind. All we have to do is seek consent, and you know, use the proper hygienic methods to kind of prevent disease. So as long as you do that, it's a perfectly good private fun. On the other hand, we also see that, you know, the project of sexual revolution has empowered, especially, you know, we see this now with the Me Too movement, empowered truly caddish men who exploited women, and epitomized by, let's say, Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein. And we can't reconcile the tension between the two. We can't reconcile the tension also between, like, as you said, on the one hand, objectify women all you want, you know, go to the strip club. On the other hand, there is objectification of women, and it hurts women. And I would argue it also leaves men ultimately unhappy, because we're relational, rational beings, and we don't just want to hook up with whoever. We want to build relationship. And so it leaves us both sexes dissatisfied and unhappy. And yet we don't go back and question whether or not sexual liberation itself was a good idea, and why it was that older civilizations, they didn't ban sexuality, but they built guardrails around it, because they understood that it was a powerful force, and that if it wasn't properly channeled, it would leave us less free. And the same thing with a homeless and addiction crisis. As you say, in all of these cases, we see this working out of a strange paradox, that the loss of traditional or natural limits and barriers was sold to us as liberation. Only with the loss of those barriers do we see that they actually kept us free. And that their loss leaves us confused, addicted, unhappy, and ultimately less free.
There's so many places I'd like to kind of go and take this, but maybe I'll just ask, because I know that you've written about this concept of what does this look like here in our our world, our society in the U.S. You know, I'll just back up and say, you know, someone here, I'm, you know, born and raised in Seattle, and typically, you know, I find myself, you know, I would say aggressively centrist. But I also, this past year, it has been really interesting to see that, the direction that we've been going almost on this cataclysmic push towards what seems to be a cliff of some kind. I'm not sure what it is. And some of the things that I've witnessed this past year, that it's almost the whole concept of, I guess the analogy, and I saw someone mention this the other day, and I don't know if this is a true story or not, but I saw someone talk about this, that they found a baby hippo and saved it and nurtured the baby hippo, fed it. When the baby hippo grew a little more, it ended up dragging the man into the river and eating him. And it was an analogy of what we're seeing in some of our politics today and in our society today, that some of the things that we're witnessing, some of it might seem good, and I see some really benefit in that. But if you give a little bit in some of these pretty radical ideas, are we going to end up just getting eaten? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even say radical ideas like, I don't know. I mean, I know the Pacific Northwest has had this scourge of old school political violence in the form of Antifa and so forth. I mean, that's a kind of extreme expression of it, but a more mundane expression that I explore through the book, but also beyond my book and in my kind of public journalism, is how we've become blind to the possibility of private tyranny. So that the little hippo that you're talking about, if I might borrow your analogy, might be private tyranny, which I'll define in a second. And it, as it grows up, we suddenly see, oh, wait, this could be a problem too. And what I mean by that is that, you know, American civilization has been, I would argue, since the founding, especially concerned with checking the possibility of public tyranny. So, in other words, we're very, very much worried about what government might do. And we've set up an entire system in many ways that is designed to make government in some ways, to tame government and to tame public tyranny, which is fine because public tyranny is a real concern. But the classical and Christian tradition was also very much always concerned with private tyranny, that is, the tyranny that's exerted by private actors, whoever that might be. It begins with the tyranny of the self, of the baser side of each of us that just is constantly seeking to be greedy or lustful and so forth. And so that in the older accounts of freedom, to be really free meant, first of all, that you've tamed and governed the interior tyrant. And that's what it meant to be, to possess self-government. It also meant that you could resist external tyranny, but it began with the ability to resist your interior drive. And then we see also kind of the possibility of private tyranny popping up in our, I would argue, and this puts me at odds with a lot of my, I'm a man of the right, but I'm almost always lately at odds with much of the mainstream right, which I think is too blind to the possibility of corporate tyranny, commercial tyranny, right? So, for example, a lot of us on the right side of the aisle said, oh, great, like big tech, like companies developing these social media platforms that'll liberate us and allow us to communicate however we want, and it'll change the face of the earth and open discussion. When in fact, it turned out that on the one hand, they have this kind of infinite scroll and all sorts of other mechanisms that are extremely addictive, especially with respect to children. And also that their overweening power that they've gained over traditional media and over the how we bleed and what we get to see and what we get to think has actually built up this kind of private tyranny, right? Like, you know, big tech censorship has now become a huge concern for a lot of us. And that's a kind of example of how it is also possible to suffer from, you know, corporate power, from overweening corporate power. So that's, I mean, an easy example. An example of similar kind that I use in the book is actually the loss of the American Sabbath. One of the questions in the Unbroken Thread is, why would God want you to take a day off? And I explore that through the life of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Hasidic figure, Hasidic intellectual from the mid-20th century. And he wrote very much about the Sabbath as a set of restrictions that are paradoxically liberating. And that's the theme we've been talking about all evening so far, is how certain traditional restrictions, while they seem to limit you, in fact, are a source of freedom. And the Sabbath is just a perfect example of this, that, you know, in this country, we've had it going back to before the founding, before there was an American Republic in the colonial era, we had this tradition of Sabbatarianism, the idea that the law should uphold one day for worship and for rest. And it wasn't just for religious purposes, in the sense that, you know, it's good for the citizenry to have one day to spend with the things of God, with scripture, with contemplation. It also had a temporal or secular aspect. And what that means is that there is, it was good to give workers a break, a rest. And Rabbi Heschel talked about that in terms of, you know, honoring the realm of time. Most of our lives is spent in the realm of space. During the 6 days of the week, we compete, we're acquisitive, we have rivalry, we have geopolitical contests, and so on and so forth. And some of those are goods. It's okay to pursue those goods. But there are other goods, such as contemplation, such as rest, which the concept of the Sabbath hallows. And so in the image of God's own celebration of creation, we set aside one day where we aren't acquisitive, we aren't competitive. And the loss of the Sabbath was sold to us again as liberation, right? It was, and it wasn't mom and pop shops that wanted to get rid of the Sunday blue laws. It was typically the a large kind of chamber of commerce businesses, and they were like, okay, well, now you get to choose. You get to shop however much you want. You can work on Sunday. Isn't that great? But in reality, it's meant that we live these very restless, harried lives. For white-collar professionals, it means that you're kind of constantly by your phone and the blue glow is telling you to do things so you can't get sleep. For more downscale workers, including at a company that has its headquarters where you are and Amazon, it means that they use algorithmic scheduling, which takes no account of whether or not, well, it's a single mom and she needs a day on Sunday to be able to, you know, go to, just rest and be with her children or whatever that may be. So in either case, both for the upper class and for the lower class, the loss of the Sabbath paradoxically proved to be a loss of liberation, a loss of freedom, even though it was sold to us as, like, choice.
Mm. Wow. I mean, that's spot on. There's so much insight in that. I mean, because I have had someone say to me in the past that, you know, the Sabbath, you know, we don't work so we can Sabbath. We Sabbath so we can work. And I think there's some truth in what you're saying there.
Right. Or as Rabbi Heschel put it, he said, you know, it's not the it's not that you you take a Sabbath just for rest. It's the culmination of the week. It reminds you, for those of us who are believers, it reminds you that everything else passes away. If all the other things you think are so important, like your arguments with your boss and blah, 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 all that is contingent. One day it'll all turn to dust. The one non-contingent eternal being is God, and that's your source of that's your ultimate refuge and a reminder once a week that, like, the things that stress you out, in fact, all of it will pass away one day. Mm. And that's just kind of the beauty of the Sabbath.
Well, I'd love, after this break,
whether you celebrate it on a Friday or a Saturday or whatever.
Right, exactly. Before I get to the question I was going to ask you before, Sohrab, I wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things that I see that I love being able to talk to folks one of my really most insightful favorite things is friends who have grown up in other countries who come here, and the perspective, it's kind of like the whole adage that you have fresh eyes and fresh perspective. And in fact, today I was just right before the show, I was talking to a good friend of mine here in Seattle who was born and raised in Cairo and, you know, has lived here for the last 20 years. And he came to America for very specific reasons and was very excited to be here and has a lot of discouragement about some of the direction that we're going in our country today. And I think there are some prominent themes that are parallels with what you're talking about. Do you see that with other immigrants that come to the U.S.? Because I feel like I see that quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think I see that in my circle, but I got to say, I also hear it, similar themes, maybe not always articulated the same way, by native-born Americans. You know, they not even people always share my particular worldview or my background, but nevertheless, I think it's fair to say we all sense that something's gone wrong with the West, and the way I always tell people is the three kind of word formula I always say is just look around you. If something is not conducive to the common good, it's not conducive to human flourishing about the way we've structured society. And maybe, you know, the germ of it was always there, but now it's found a kind of extreme, total expression. And yeah, I mean, believe it. I mean, I because of the release of the new book, Broken Thread, I've gone kind of around the country talking to different people. And so many people, again, from people whose backgrounds are, you know, I guess less exotic than mine, this stuff will resonate with them.
Let's talk about, I was reading an article, an essay that you wrote 5 years ago called My Journey from Tehran to Rome in the Catholic Herald. Powerful essay talking about you mentioned your worldview and just the journey that you're on. Can you share with our listeners that journey? You know, obviously, I'm sure you could talk a long time about it, but I'd love to just have our listeners hear your perspective there.
Yeah, sure. I'll give the 2-3 minute version. So, yeah, I mean, I was born in Iran to a kind of middle class, educated, urban family, very typically secular, as many Iranians are. And my parents had supported the Iranian revolution, not because they supported Ayatollah Khomeini, but because they had fuzzy notions that the revolution would bring about a kind of fairer, more small-d democratic society, and then almost instantly came to regret it. I became an atheist when I was 13 years old while still living in Iran, because I just assumed that, you know, if there is a God and it's the God of the Islamic Republic, meaning a kind of cruel God who needs a sort of police state to enforce his whims, and that includes using judicial amputations and judicial floggings, then I want nothing to do with God. And I came to the United States, luckily through the Family Preference Program, aka chain migration, assuming that America is going to be this land of total secularity and individualism, a kind of decadent Manhattan of the 1980s you would see in the movies. That was the America I thought I would get to. In fact, I landed in Utah, which is very Mormon and very religious, and it's a bit of a shock. Long story why we ended up initially in Utah. But, you know, I just almost immediately turned all my oppositional energies, which had been formerly directed at the Iranian Ayatollahs, against what remained, I suppose, of the United States kind of Judeo-Christian heritage and any kind of moral traditionalism. And that led me to becoming ultimately by my late teens and early 20s, became a kind of full-on Marxist. And actually, I spent time in Seattle because I wanted to be close to the headquarters of the particular Marxist sect that I had picked. But then over time, I changed my mind. I mean, I'm very open about it. I think a lot of people go through these conversions and don't write about them. But because I've been open about it, I think I get accused sometimes of being a frequent convert. But it's always been in one direction. So eventually, you know, I began to read more widely than I had, and I actually got to read the Bible, and I thought, okay, well, this speaks to something. There's this, first of all, this longing for sacrifice and expiation in my own life that I feel that somehow I'm interiorly broken and I need to be redeemed, and that this speaks to that very profoundly, and that I have a conscience that tells me what I do wrong and urges me to do well. And so I decided that that's proof that there is an objective morality, an objective moral order that exists outside of just my own head. And if that such a thing exists, then there must be a God who is the sort of supreme lord of that objective moral order. And ultimately decided there is a personal God. So this is the proof from conscience that also C.S. Lewis ultimately championed in Mere Christianity, although I didn't know it at the time or put it in the terms that he did. So to make a long story short, then it took like, 20 years from the point I decided I was an atheist to, you know, reading Pope Benedict's books and a few providential encounters with the Catholic Mass, to the point where I was working for the Wall Street Journal in London in 2016. And I walked into a church and decided I want to become a Roman Catholic. And that's where I was received.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I love just hearing those personal journeys, those personal stories, and I'm certainly with you, you know, just that understanding of a, you know, a personal God. It's not, you know, a religion, you know, it's a relationship. And C.S. Lewis is one of my all-time favorites. So I love hearing you mention C.S. Lewis. Absolutely. What parish do you have there in New York City?
So I go to St. Agnes, which is the parish that's entrusted to Opus Dei, which is a Catholic order. And then some, but other times I go to St. Vincent Ferrer, which is a Dominican parish. So I, depending on whether I'm taking my family or not, because one of them, the mass is much longer. And if I'm going with my kids, I go to the shorter one.
Yes. Yes. I understand that perfectly. Well,
you were a preacher, so.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. My kids. Hey, come on, Dad. Let's go. Looking at the clock. Come on now. Oh, my goodness. Sourabh, by the way, we're talking to Sourabh Amari. He is the author of the brand new book, The Unbroken Thread, opinion editor at the New York Post. And Sourabh, if you could have your druthers this is the outcome I would love to see readers take from the book, what would you say?
I mean, I just hope to persuade them that because the book is very much addressed to an urban secular audience. And I would love for them to, I don't know, if they can minimally come away with the idea that that our ancestors, broadly speaking, weren't just, you know, closed-minded, superstitious fools, but there was a reason they ordered certain things a certain way, traditionally speaking. And that therefore, if you're a true small d Democrat, as G.K. Chesterton said, you should extend democracy and the franchise, not just to the living, but also to the dead. And that the dead have a claim on us because they have this kind of accumulated wisdom. Just be open enough to it. that would be good enough for me, even if you're not persuaded by, you know, the majority of the arguments.
And Sourabh, I'm not even going to ask you this because we're in Seattle, which is the birthplace of Amazon. But where can people pick up the book?
So obviously on Amazon, but also, you know, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, all the kind of big mainstream publisher, probably your independent bookstore, whatever that may be. And then directly from the publisher, that's Penguin Random House, and that's penguinrandomhouse.com.
That's great. That's great. Hey, I love to ask our guests here, just, you know, kind of one final question is, how do you want to be remembered when you just think of life? How do you want to be remembered?
I really mean it because I've been writing a lot and I've been getting a lot of attention for the book. But I really want to be remembered as a good dad, which is a different thing. It's one thing to write a book about it. It's another thing, as you know, the example that you set, and that's a lot harder. And I'm not at all saying I've mastered any of it. I'm just kind of rolling with the punches as one does, but that's legitimately more important than to me, because it has to do with posterity and it has to do with coming to terms with your own death. And and writing a book about it, like as I said, will not necessarily at all help you in that regard. It's a much harder task.
Absolutely. And of those chapters that you write individually, you mentioned the Sabbath, the theme of the Sabbath. Is there another one that really, I mean, I'm sure they all stand out to you, but is there another one that is like, oh, if someone had literally 5 minutes left to read a chapter, what chapter should they read?
5 minutes left in life, I would say. Let's assume that, God forbid. But the final chapter is, remember, they're all questions. The final chapter is, what's good about death? And it's especially pertinent as we just came out of a horrible pandemic. It's told through the life of Seneca, the great Roman philosopher statesman. He did not have the benefit of revelation. He was contemporaneous with Christ, but he was not a Christian himself. Obviously, he was a pagan. Nevertheless, he spoke very movingly about the fact that it helps to live life if you wake up every day thinking that it could be your last day. Not to be morbid about it at all, but just that there's a possibility. And if you think about it and think about death as this absolute limit that you're going to hit no matter what in your natural life, you know, if you have a supernatural vision, if you're a believer, that's a different question. But all of us who have a natural life have this ultimate limit to deal with, and not to try to live in too much anxiety about death. Not to be, again, not to be reckless, not to be nihilistic or morbid, but know that it could happen, and therefore to live life fully, responsibly, fully engaged. I think it's a very moving chapter, if I may toot my own horn.
I appreciate that. The book is called The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Sohrab Ahmari, thank you so much for being with us today on the Live from Seattle program. It was really engaging and thought-provoking. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
And next time you're in Seattle, let's grab a cup of coffee.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. That was Sohrab Ahmari.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.